Welcome to another episode of The Gateway. My name is Russ, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts Amin and Biagio. For this episode, The Gateway is excited to welcome Ansel Ravado, a software engineer who has been a full-stack developer with 25 years of experience in the industry. Ansel has extensive experience with server-side software development and data processing. Projects that Ansel has worked on include performance tuning, user interface design, web application development, and database administration. Ansel has also administered projects using AWS services and Google Cloud services. He is well-versed in containerized application development and distribution computing solutions. Ansel is constantly pursuing knowledge and looking beyond programming languages for solutions that gives results. Ansel, welcome to The Gateway. It is a pleasure to have you today.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Perfect. We are really excited because we always end up talking with guests that have conceptual knowledge, that have a lot of expertise, that are talking philosophically. And then it's always nice to have someone who's actually doing it, like on the ground floor in the real world doing these things. And I think our students, I think our audiences are really excited about that stuff. So I want to begin this conversation where most of these start. And it's, how did you get to where you are today? What was that path like?
You know, I should start at the beginning because it is an interesting path. So I grew up in the Caribbean and I was just a kid, you know, running around playing in the dirt, that kind of stuff. And I remember one summer, our neighbor, I think they were cleaning out and they wanted to get rid of all of their magazines, and they had stacks and stacks of these computer magazines, Computer World or something like that. I remember it was the thick one. And I wanted them. And so I got them, and I just, that summer, I read all of them. I went through and I read all of them. I said, this is what I want to do. I ended up, I took apart my father's computer, and it was the one computer in the house that he used for work. I took it apart to see how it worked. And I had to put it back together again, and it had to work by morning because he needed it for work in the morning.
That is pressure. That is higher pressure than any class, than any boss you can ever have.
Oh, my God.
It is.
You know, an interesting thing. I did, well, didn't have to put it together, but I remember helping a friend of mine, a brother-in-law, actually. They were working on upgrading a server, and I was helping. And the whole thing crashed and it had to be rebuilt overnight.
All of our audience is listening to these two stories and the pressure that comes with them. And they're like, I don't know if this is the career path for me.
Well, the thing is, if you can get through those things and still want to do it, you're in. That's
hooked.
It.
Yeah, you're hooked. It's your pathway. Sorry we keep interrupting. And so this is just so exciting and we're enjoying it. So you're saying, so you built your dad's computer. Did you fix it? Did you hit the deadline?
No, he took it apart.
Or he took it apart.
He took it apart, yes. That's what
I wanted to see how it worked. And I put it back together and it worked.
Perfect. Impressive.
How old are you? How old were you at that time?
I think I was 15.
Okay.
Your parents had to be really proud that Computer World was the stack of magazines you were taking then as a young boy at 15.
And were they still proud when the computer was taken apart before it was put together? Were they? Well, how were they feeling?
Well, now that I think about it, I'm surprised they even let me do it. But but it wasn't a secret.
Okay.
I just said, get it working in the morning, he needs it.
That is awesome. So while you were freelancing at 15, what was that next step? How did you turn this interest, this aptitude that you had into where you're at now?
I think it was a combination of so many steps. So I loved math. I loved physics. Those were actually two of my favorite subjects. I loved those books. I loved messing with computers. I remember my parents bought us a Tandy something. I forgot the name of it now, but it was a computer that didn't have any storage unless you bought the cassette tape recorder. And which kind of worked. And
sorry, what year is that you are using magnetic tape as storage?
That's in the 80s.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It was a wild time.
I remember we got a book of programs, a book of computer games, that is. I'm talking about a book where it has the code for the computer games. And to play the game, you have to type in the code, then you play the game, and when you turn the computer off, it's gone.
Like a Zen computer game at that time, you know, you're just in the moment.
We need to bring those back, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I couldn't type very well, so I remember there was a skiing game in there, and I asked my oldest brother to type it in for me, and he did, and we played it, and it was great, and then we turned the computer off, and it was gone. But also, I remember in the back of my math book, I would write computer programs just for fun, just to, you know, written down. And then when I was able to go to college, I actually got a scholarship to go to college in Colorado at Regis University. And I decided I had a math scholarship, so I had to major in math, but I wanted to do computer science. So the only way I could do it was to double major. And so I did. And that was a lot of work, but I loved it. And I passed cum laude. And from there, I had my first job, which was not programming, but just support. And, you know, you run around, you set up computers, you change, you know, fix printers, that kind of stuff, run cables. And I did that for 1 year. And then a friend of mine who I grew up with, who graduated with me, was actually in a graduate program at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And he said, hey, why don't you come here? You can be a teaching assistant. They'll take care of your tuition. And I said, yes. So it was because of him, I was able to apply and I got accepted. And I went to UTK and I majored in computer science with a specialization in software engineering. And I loved it. And one of my favorite classes, which is also a class that broke my brain, was Foundations of Computing. Mm-hmm. And the reason it broke my brain was that I remember one class, I was listening and trying to understand, and I felt like I was losing my mind, and I answered a question correctly, and I didn't understand what I said. And the teacher would tell us, he does not expect us to do well, but if we try hard, he'll give us a gentleman's C.
You get degrees.
They really do. We often tell our students that. I like that. That is, well, for real, like a lot of times we have this mentality that education needs to be, in at least in America, you need to be 100%, you need to be 92% an A, all of that stuff. And really, that's the result of it. It's, did you learn or not? Can you do this stuff? And that's I know Biagio and Amin really try and work with that students.
I hate grades. If I can just score learning, that's it. And even putting on a scale is, everybody starts from a different position, right? Somebody like you has the attitude to these things might come very easy or easier than somebody else that doesn't have that, like naturally. Or it's not as driven as you towards it. So it's should be relative to where you're starting, is relative to, but in the end of the day, how much you put is how much you learn and how much you take out of it. So it doesn't matter if it's an A or a C, I'm pretty sure you learn a good bit. Because I know what you can do with it. So yeah, so that's what it matters.
Yeah, that's great. And it makes me think about the stuff I've learned since I've gone to school. So I graduated and everything, and I remember doing a thesis project and it was garbage, but I did it. Oh, you want to know why it was garbage?
Yes, please, of course. And so you're rapidly going up our charts of our favorite guest. At least our students, they're like, okay, this is a real guy telling us the real stuff.
All right, so I was working with a professor, and he was working on this engine that would help people play music without having to play all the notes. So you could play like a few notes, and it would play the rest of it for you. And so you could, you know, kind of like a toy, but he wanted it to be, you know, it was like a proof of concept type of thing. My part of it was to write the user interface for it, and I had to write it in Windows, and I hate Windows, but I had to write it there, and it was especially garbage because I did not do the graphics translation correctly, where you're supposed to be doing matrix calculation, and instead of trying to calculate everything, you just calculate the change and you do relative positioning, all that stuff. I didn't do that. I did brute force absolute positioning, horrible loop programming.
So you needed like a GPU to run a form.
Probably. Yeah. It was terrible, but I got it to work.
Okay, it worked, yeah.
Quote unquote.
Audience cannot see the double quote.
Now that we're on the topic, you went to like the perfect academic route. You got a double major in math and computer science, and you got your master's in computer science, and then you went to industry. So how much, and you had like a successful career and you have experience. So it is a combination of what you learned in industry and what you learned in, you know, at school. How would you say school helped, or how necessary it was, how, like, you're right out of master's program and you're trying to work as a developer, and what happens? Like, are you surprised every day by things that you should know and you don't, or the opposite, or something like that?
There's a universe of things you need to learn after you graduate. But the first thing that I had to do was to find a way to be a programmer. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't get a job saying, you know, you are a software developer and here you go.
Yeah,
I got a job at a nonprofit where I was computer support, where I, you know, I fixed the printers, I installed things, I, you know, ran the cables, that kind of stuff. However, I also knew that I had the skills to write software. I had the confidence, maybe overconfidence, but I had the confidence I had at least the fundamentals and I could figure it out. And I convinced the director to let me rewrite the software. And the things that I had to learn, and I think that they didn't fully teach us, even though they taught us some stuff, was how to effectively start and run a project from start to end in a real world. And it comes down to communication and making sure that what you're doing actually provides value and finding a solution that will outlive yourself. Because the company had, they have had people come before who wrote software from external companies. They would write it in something that was not supportable after they left and it died. They had two of that. And then they also had another one where an employee wrote the software and it worked, but the employee left and now the software languished. And so I took that information and I created a set of requirements. The requirement was, well, it has to work, but also I need to find something that will be supported, that they can afford, and that can be expanded on in the future. And fortunately, I found out that they were using Lotus Notes, which, you know, nobody uses anymore. But IBM Lotus Notes is a distributed database software, which I found out can also be used to write actual software with some additional tweaks and hacks, but not really hacks, but more like I'm going to push it hard. And so there were things that were missing from it. For example, it didn't have a relational database. It didn't have reporting capabilities. But what it did have was the ability to export information and to use, export information. That was it. And the fact that it was a distributed database actually was helpful, because imagine you're trying to write software that has to work across a bunch of machines during the days when you still had dial-up. This actually worked in that case. For example, it was multiple locations. We had a location where we had to have people be able to manage cases. So it was like case management, and they needed to have IDs for their cases and so on. How do you make sure that everyone has a unique ID for each case in a distributed system where some of the machines are not even online all the time? And they would sync like once a day. How do you do that? So I figured out that what I could do is I could actually pre-generate unique IDs and distribute them. And by learning what their throughput is per day, I'd make sure they would have enough, more than double. And that way they can work. It's all working on their local machine. And then when they sync, everything syncs and everybody has a unique ID and it's all good. So I was able to figure out how to make that work. And then because the Lotus Notes software was supported by the larger organization, it was naturally supportable and it was extendable. And then I extended the reporting capabilities by using the export feature and writing that in Java, which it supported, to export into a database so I could present reports using WebSphere and something. I forget what it was, but you know, the old stuff, the oldies and goodies.
Knowing the business was the key. Knowing how the business works was the key for you to writing the correct software, even though everyone had the same technical capabilities, but that knowing that business part was your strength.
Yes, and working with the people. For example, one of the pilot application, we went through to each department and figured, if we can get the cashiers to work, then we can get everybody to work. And so I actually at times would sit beside the cashier coding, asking questions, making changes rapidly. And then showing, you know, like the shorter the feedback loop, the better the software is. The closer you can be to the person actually using the software, the better you can make it.
Right. I want to jump in, and I think I also need to apologize with you, because we still didn't let you get to where you are right now and what you're doing right now, because it's such a cool kind of like part. And some of the stuff you're talking about, I think I can relate, but I think some of our listener like are like, why he has to do all these things and why seems complicated. You make it look easy, right? The fact that you find those solution at that time, it's to me is pretty incredible. What comes to my mind though is now that we have AI, right, and we have these incredible tools that can help you out with all this coding, that can help you out with the reasoning in some of these models, right? How much you feel that, let me rephrase this. Do you feel like you wasted time in trying to figure it out the hard way? Or do you think because you learn how to figure it out the hard way, now that you have this, is, you know, it's game changer, because you can do more efficiently and faster and, you know, on steroids, like I like to call it, I say on steroids, right? Or you just have regrets. You just wish you were born now and you could have done so much more faster. What is your take on this?
I wouldn't change anything. So I am glad that I lived through not even having memory, as in storage, all the way to now where, you know, You have something small in your thumb and you can store everything you ever
need. Cloud storage.
But the thing is, the thing that I discovered is that with computer science, besides quantum computing, there is no magic. It's really all fundamentals, right? which is one of the reasons I say fundamental computing is my favorite class, even though it was the hardest one, because everything comes down to the fundamentals, right? In computers, you've got logic gates, you've got time, you've got memory, you've got loops, you have assignments, right? That's it. Find a solution within that, and you're good to go, right? And then the speed of light is constant. So if you can do something in memory, that's the fastest place you can do it. As soon as you have to start to travel, it's going to be slower. That's just it.
Yeah, those haven't changed. But that is the hardest way to think about it. Biagio is right. That is the hardest way to think about it.
No. I actually love his answer. I remember this very clearly. When I was at LSU, I was a PhD student there. We went through a revolution of the intro class to information system because nobody wanted to teach those things, right? But if you don't understand how the computer works and operates, then it's very hard to even think about what it's capable of doing or why it's capable of doing some things better than some other things. Right? So there was the big debate because we are in a college of business, we are not computer science, but if you don't understand that, right, you are missing, again, the understanding of how it operates is critical to even think about what can you do with it. And what you just said, it makes perfect sense to me. And when I go to class and I teach coding in a business school, then I'm getting more and more questions about why are you even teaching us this, right? I can write in English in AI and ChatGPT, whatever model I'm using, can write the code and it's faster than me. But again, if you don't have the foundation, if you don't understand the code that's been wrote, how do you know that it's always going to work? Like you were saying, right? Is one thing that it works and leave short. I can build a mock app by drawing or a mock website by drawing on a piece of paper. It's going to do it for me. But how do I know that it's going to last long? It's going to be, it's serving the people, adding value to the people that are using the software. And that's why, to me, information system is so fascinating, is the people plus the technology. And if you're just focusing on the technology and not focusing on the people, it's going to be short-lived. You're not making a difference. So but the hearing from you is really because sometimes I feel like I want to go back to my PhD and have the time because I was spending hours and hours to figure it out. I don't know, HPC running code in Bash, which is not my expertise. I don't come from a computer science background and stuff like that. With AI, I could have done it in a couple of weeks, but I think it was part of the growth. It was part of the, Stack Overflow was my ChatGPT, I guess. I don't know, but yeah.
I mean, still very useful, Stack Overflow.
Absolutely, I know. I still use it, but the new generation thinks, what is that? You are an old man.
Well, interestingly, you talk about teaching, and for the last 5 years, I've been thinking about that actually, because the thing that I've learned most in my career is not the code. It's like, how do you break down and solve a problem, right? And how do you communicate with people to make sure that you're solving the right problem? They understand what you're producing. And then how do you organize yourself so that you actually deliver the value that they're looking for? And that's hard, but that's a whole different skill set than just writing code.
We are I think that we need to have the foundation to understand how to write the code and what the code does, but it's critical thinking, is problem solving, is those are the skills that, no matter how good AI is gonna get, if you don't have them, it's just not human. And it's not there with the people that are using those technology, right? So it's a different, you had it already. You see, this is the interesting part of me. it was always in you, even before he was even thinking about that. I know a lot of people that thought that you can just write software and that's it, but it's not just about the technical skills, it's the whole package.
But I have a question. Do you use AI? What do you use it for?
I use it a lot for many different things. So I've actually...
And end of answer. That's all.
Drop the mic.
Right before this meeting, I was in the process of writing and doing some research because we are trying to... So I'm the leader of my team. We have some members who are offshore. So they're on the other side of the world, different time zone. We want to be able to organize our work so that we are delivering actionable work to them so that they can just gobble it up, produce the result, and give it back, right? So I asked them, give me examples of tickets that we've given you that are really well formed and that you were able to execute on. They gave me the tickets. I exported the information from the tickets. I put it in a document. I loaded it up into Notebook LM. I started doing some research against those documents to get some insights from it. I got those insights. I had some additional questions and then started to categorize them. I copied that categorization into a Confluence document. And then from those, I'm reading through it to look for things that would give me some kind of guidance. And I realized, well, why don't I just ask it to give me guidance? And so I did, and it produced another document with guidance on how I would communicate how best to put tickets together. And now I'm reading through that, and then I'm going to distill it even more into something where now I can give my in-house team specific guidance and things that we know they can do to make handing over tickets more successful. But through this whole time, I'm using it as a tool.
Yeah.
So I'm using it more like an English tool where I know the information and I'm using it to transform that information based on the intent that I am giving it.
Makes sense.
But it's for a specific goal.
Yeah. You're still running the show here.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it seems like you have to because the computer still doesn't have that capability. And so, and just to point to Biagio, I do use AI to like debug my code and see what's wrong with it. But sometimes it just tells me, write it this way and it'll work. And it's just not because it's using, for example, attributes of a different package on the current package. It thinks that, yeah, you just, if you run this command on all of the packages, it will work. Go for it. And especially the packages like and things that are not that known. So information wise, it's not that rich for when you get to a specific. But if you want, yeah, to help you with putting information into a certain usable format, I think it does very well.
And it does help with coding. So I use I use GitHub Copilot, and I am also using Cursor with the paid subscription. And I've tried the Cursor agent. We have a bunch of code that requires some refactoring, and I have not been able to get Cursor to refactor it effectively. I have to do it myself. I actually got Cursor to apologize because how poor it was doing. I did it so much better. I said, no, this is not what I want. And then I wrote the whole thing, and I said, this is what I want. And it said, I am so sorry.
we need an Ansel GPT, not Cursor.
Yeah, GPT, yeah, exactly. Just the first one that feels bad.
You created an emotional machine.
I honestly run into something similar to that. And another observation I have, and I don't know if that's happened to you, because I do write code and I'm building materials with it and stuff like that. So it's I'm not at your level. I don't consider myself a developer or a full stack developer by any means. But sometimes what I notice is two concerning things. One is the solution that it gives you is very reasonable, right? So again, you might go hours and hours in the direction it's pushing you, especially if you don't have the expertise of, sometimes for me, it can be some JavaScript code, which I don't know very well, or whatever it goes around it. And I go hours with it, and then I realize it's contradicting itself. And it's like, I am in a loop, and I'm just rolling with it, and I'm wasting more time than if I just go figure it out the old school way. And the other thing is, sometimes it's similar prompt or pretty much the same prompt gives me slightly different code or recommendation. And that's reproducibility issue can also be, I think, one of the weaknesses. And then the third one I tell to my students is, what if it's down? You just tell your boss, I can't do nothing today. I don't know any code. Just I cursor agent for, you know, a fraction of what you are paying me, basically. But that's a different story.
That's why they call it generative AI. So I took a lot of time to read exactly how it works and what it's doing. Because of all of the calculations and all of the weights and the whole matrix and everything, they also introduce some randomization, because you want it to be able to generate something unique. And so you start with a little bit of randomization so that it will go through slightly different paths, but you never know which path it's actually going through, because everything had to be trained. And so because of all the neural networks, you don't know exactly what the outcome's gonna be, but with enough training, you get better outcomes. Mm-hmm. I find that it's, because of that, it can actually solve problems that were previously unsolvable, or at least intractable with traditional computing. There's the example of the, and I hope I'm saying this right, the suitcase packing problem, where you want to write a program that will give you the most optimal way to pack suitcases in a confined space. It works well for small spaces and becomes intractable as you go larger. It just becomes incomputable. But if you can do something like fuzzy programming, which is what they called it at the time, now you just put AI on it, which is pretty fuzzy enough, but you'll get a good answer quickly at very large sizes. And I think that's what AI is good for. For example, what it can do with driving, the number of calculations and decisions a car would have to make while driving is something that is, I would say, impossible to do with traditional programming, but you can do it with neural networks. So it has its place, absolutely, but you have to know what the place is.
And you need to know what is giving you back, right? Because if you have no idea, you're just gonna copy and paste. Is dangerous. Yeah. More than that's kind of like the dark side of it, in my opinion, right? If we over rely on it, or if you just use it just because it's cool, or just because of you know, everybody's using it, right? They say AI is gonna replace developer, or better, developer that use AI gonna replace developer that don't use AI, right? But I'm not sure if it is. If it is, you know, just AI replacing developer as it is, right?
Well, I would say if you're doing something where you find yourself zoning out, then a computer can do it. If you're doing something where you have to be actively engaged, chances are a computer can't do it.
That's so interesting. It's the first time I've heard that evaluation. That makes sense. In addition to Turing test, we should do that test too. That's Ansel test. Yeah, I like it. I like it very much. Okay. I can never zone out. My attention span is so low that I have to actively every time work to keep it on. So I wouldn't be a good test subject.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think about, you mentioned neural networks, and we know that neural networks are expensive to run, expensive to train. And also, you also mentioned that we never know what they're going to, you know, generate. And do you think that's the fundamental problem, or like, should we be able to, like,
if and because we don't know what never it's gonna generate, it's a challenge to. There are some illegal outputs, right? I mean, by illegal, I'm not talking about laws that are, exist in society. I'm like the wrong. There are decidedly wrong outputs, but there is no way to just say that prevent those because we don't know if it will or will not. We the only approach we have for that is like the blacklist approach. We say, here's an unpermitted output. If this is detected, stop it. But that list is not necessarily exhaustive. So we can't just look into the formulation and the formulas and say, oh, if we put these parameters, fix these parameters, it will not generate something that is unpermitted. So do you think that's a problem or do you think we are going to find a way around that?
So the way that I've seen them approach that problem is to use a combination of experts, as in multiple neural networks that do different things. So let's say, for example, you have a neural network where you're asking it to produce the color red, and then you have another one that will know the difference between red and everything else. You have the first one produce the output, it's more mauve or whatever. The other one says no.
Yeah.
And it goes back and it tries again. You can do that. And it can be more nuanced than that, but that's like a yes or no type of example.
Yeah.
Isn't that the hallucination problem? Like what you're talking about?
Yeah, putting hallucination problem. They call it guardrails now. And then the hallucination and also basically people, it can also learn from things that are incorrect, right? Take material off the internet and it's full of wrong things.
And yes, it will learn from what you give it.
Yeah, like it's learned from what it's given and it could generalize from it too. Its main ability is that it could generalize from it. And it, if it could like look at, let's say, racist material, then it can come up with new racist things. It can do that all. So it can generalize. We have seen that. But what I'm saying is it seems like there is no sure way that we could, there's no parameter or set of parameters that we could go adjust and prevent that.
We can certainly mitigate it. There's an idea of using smaller neural networks, more specialized neural networks, that we can better predict the outcome because the combinations of outcomes is less and it does a specific thing so well. Yeah. If it does it any multiplier better than a person does it, then it's usable. And I have the examples of the machines where they're picking bad apples from good apples. They're doing that in milliseconds from just looking at them.
Yeah.
And they're doing it like all day and all night.
Yeah.
You can't beat that.
No.
People can't do that.
Right.
So answer is that SML, right? Small instead of large language, sorry. SLM, small language model rather than large language model. That's what you're talking about? Or is more
smaller models.
SLM, sorry. I confused it.
Now the thing is, everything's smaller, right? So we're talking about neural networks, but language models is a specific implementation of neural networks. And you have neural networks that do other things too. I find it interesting because a lot of the buzz has come around when the language models came out, but they're building on all the previous work of things that we've been using for years.
It's just how people can access them, I think, is more of just not a niche anymore, right? It's everybody can download an app or go to the website and speak English and get a bunch of things. And before it wasn't like that. Again, running some code on the HPC was for me learning a lot of new things and working with a terminal. I never done anything like that. And so that can be intimidating, but this is easy to use and accessible, very But it has a cost, right? I know it's not your expertise, but it has a cost of, you know, environment cost, sustainability and everything like that. And a lot of people just play with it to create funny images, but then behind there is so much energy wasted and an impact on the environment. But yeah, that's very, very neglected aspect of it.
Yeah, I think about that too. The first time I thought about something like that was way back in, I guess, my first real job after college, not grad school. I remember installing all these computers that were spending thousands of dollars, and they were playing solitaire. And the joke I would say is that all these scientists for all these years, this is what it's for. Yes.
Yeah. It's pretty mind nice. Sweep, I love it. Yeah. Oh, I love that. I have both of them on my phone. Nostalgic.
Now, Ansel, I want to go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that my wife likes to share these AI generated videos of cats in these just funny situations where they're walking around and doing stuff. And that's what it's for. Yes. All this math.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, admittedly, those cats are cute. Like they cover the cute quota. So I'm in.
Cute. It's like, I think there needs to be a channel just for that. Yes.
I agree. I think, see, I bet Ansel's over here just coming up with great ideas left and right. This is good. The problems we really need solved nowadays, you know?
I'm glad we're recording.
Yes. But all jokes aside, I'm interested to see your opinion and your perspective on working with the next group of computer programmers, the ones that are kind of having to learn some of these fundamentals while AI's in the background saying, maybe I could do that. Like, this isn't important. As they're coming into industry and potentially working on your teams or your colleagues, however the hierarchy may be, is there any bit of advice you could give to someone who's maybe graduating soon or has a plan to go into this? Or, because I know a lot of our students have a real fear that what they're going into isn't going to be a job. You know, some of them are like, well, I have to graduate now because I've spent 3.5 years, but it's going to be all AI in 4 years. If you can kind of speak on that, I'd be very interested in your perspective.
So the way I'll answer that is I would talk about what I would do with someone on my team, right?
Perfect.
So I have a combination of people on my team and, you know, different experience levels and so on. And the thing that I focus on is, they would say process, but for me, it's more like coordination and communication and problem solving. If you can do those, it doesn't matter what the tools are.
That is the simplest way I've heard. A very complex way of looking at life. And so I'm absolutely in love with that, because I don't even think of it like that. And that answer to all of it, like, for whatever industry you're in, it's still going to be problem solving and it's still going to be working together. I'm speechless. I got nothing.
I think, like, first of all, we need to have Ansel back because he's just genius, and we did never let him finish the whole part to where he is, and we don't even know where he is right now. But it's very refreshing. It's very refreshing to have people, I think, like you, that look at these things from the right perspective. It's lately, I don't know, maybe because of the situation that we are living in, or there is so many things that can happen, or the kind of like the dark side of it more than the bright side of it. But I think if all of us have kind of an approach to it, like Ansel is doing, the message is still positive for the new workforce. It's like, it's not going to take all your jobs away. You just need to adapt to kind of using them. But those soft skills, those not pure technical skills are going to be what is somebody like Ansem looking for, and you can still develop them, or even sometimes it can help you in developing them even better, right? I think that's kind of going to be the key, how you leverage these tools rather than being afraid of them, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of it. I know that there are dark sides, but it's a powerful hammer, and hammers break things, but they also build things. So let's build some things.
Let's do it.
That's and absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and I've also enjoyed these tidbits of pure wisdom that you're sending out there, Ansel, whether you know it or not. But I always enjoy the black box algorithms that we have out there, the ones that they're just making a choice and we don't exactly know why. And I find your experience early on in your education when you answered something and it was right and you didn't even know how it was right. I'm like, oh, it's all circling back around. So maybe AI in another 20 years and industry experience will be someone like you just dropping amazing amounts of wisdom on us.
You know, we generally, this is how our episodes go. We go, let's talk about this cool thing. And in the end, we talk about, oh my God, this is going to destroy the world. It hasn't gone like that this time.
It has been. That's a testament to you, Ansel.
Yeah,
so
this has been very positive and hopeful. I love it. Yeah, it should be more like this.
Perfect. Yeah. Ansel, I want to end on one basic question here. And again, it's going back to kind of preparing the next group of people going out. But if there was one attribute or quality that you were looking for, if you were hiring someone, of course, assuming that you still need the technical ability, like you need to be able to do the job. But if they meet that quality, if they have the training and they are qualified for that position, what are those, what's a quality that really starts to kind of separate someone from being a candidate to potentially being a hire?
That is a great question. I just came out of a few interviews because I've been interviewing people, and I would say that the thing that attracted me to some of them was their ability to communicate, to be honest about what they don't know, and be eager, almost ravenous to learn. And with those qualities, you know, you can go pretty far because not everybody knows everything. I don't know everything. I know that there's tons I don't know. But what I do is that I read, I listen, and I learn as much as I can. And I communicate. So I talk to people and, you know, learn from them and just be honest about what I don't know and try to be helpful.
And so, can I connect? Again,
perfect.
Yeah. Can I connect one thing, though? Is like, because we have a lot of international students as well, and it's very tough for them. And it is a tough market, I would say. Is there one thing to just get to the point of interviewing with you? Like, how can they, I recommend to them, build a portfolio, showcase your technical skills and your communication skills within report or dashboarding or whatever it is, right? But what will be like one way to say, okay, this resume is worth, you know, bring it to the next stage, right? And what is something that you just tired of looking in the resume?
It's an interesting question because the workforce has changed, where at one point, you know, all you had to be was a programmer and people just gobble you up. But it's not like that anymore. And what I see is that companies are looking for people that fill a specific need. And sometimes you need to go to companies that you are not thinking about, where you might fill their need. And what you need to do is you also need to cast a really wide net and be comfortable with the fact that you will get 90% silence. But for the ones that do reach out, you know, follow up, listen to them, be honest about what you know and what you don't know, where you are, what you're looking for as well, because you are interviewing them too. And you will find a place where you fit, because fitting somewhere is actually very important. I've been at a place where I didn't feel like I fit. I was paid very well, hated it every day. It was beginning to change me. I was becoming a miserable person. I quit. I accepted a position at another place where I was making less money, much happier.
Those are all really important things, Ansel. Thank you so much for your time and your openness and your willingness to share. We've been very positive and jovial, but truly, I think some of the things you've shared have been very impactful and will really help our students and our listeners. So thank you so much for your time. We will have you back whenever we're just feeling too depressed. We'll just be like, Ansel, please come and tell us some good things about the world. Okay. But truly, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. This was great.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by Northern Illinois University, where your future is our focus. And please, remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.